Right. So I'm here as part of the several multi-class introduction to where data comes from. Okay, and I still think about it the way that Mark and I discussed several years ago when we started to think about how to approach these topics in this course. You had two great lectures from Jim Noonan. You now have a really good, broad understanding of where some of the most important genome data is coming from and how it's generated. And my topic touches on an area of expertise and research that I do in my own laboratory, but I've also been thinking broadly in terms of this class. And so the topics is it's proteins, but broken down mainly into proteomics. But we're also going to talk about protein-protein interactions, and you'll see how these approaches, this type of research, is really driving data sets, the types of data sets that you're going to think about now and into the future. So without further ado, I always like to start by pointing out this very obvious and overly simplified rules for life that I'm confident you've all been exposed to. This is the central dogma. And in this course, and certainly in these first four lectures, we're going to talk about how data, large data sets derived primarily with new technology, is informing us more and more about how central this process is and how exciting it is in the world of biology, where we can now make startling new conclusions and grasp problems that face us in medicine. What are the properties of the human genome and how they're really borne out in this central process in biology? We're now trying to tackle things about structures of whole cells and even substructures, organelles, all with the same rules and codes. And then, of course, you know that where we may be talking, I'm sure Jim was talking heavily about maybe sequencing humans, but the reality is you can sequence and understand DNA, RNA, protein from many, many different life forms. And so we're not going to really get into this population dynamics or evolution of it, but surely you can appreciate there's a vast amount of information that spans life in many, many ways. And then what I just have here is this little icon to remind us that we really need a lot of computational power to grasp some of these concepts. And certainly take this into experimental biology and take this very simple formula and really translate it into the types of questions that we want the answers to in our lifetime, right? And so what type of things can you get? What types of stories, what types of projects can be carried out? And these are just two, I think, very important findings, pieces of work that I'm sure you're all aware of. And I'm not going to make a statement about the ethics behind any of this, but surely you're aware that all of our efforts in understanding how cells work have really decoded some very important properties of stem cells. And so we know through, you know, an elegant study like this one in Cell, how to really reprogram a cell from a differentiated state to a pluripotent state. And there's no question that large bodies of information, many, many different types of areas of research all distill down into this type of feat. But then on the other side, you can think about harnessing everything you know about genes and genomes and synthesis to come up with a path to actually recreate an entire free-form piece of life, right? In this case, it's a deadly strain of influenza. But there are efforts ongoing right now to synthesize whole genomes, transplant them, and make new organisms, right? So these are just important points. Now, what's not going to be discussed, but I just have to point something out for the purposes of this class, we're looking at sequencing DNA, sequencing RNA, and we're going to talk extensively about protein information. But unless you've been living under a rock and you haven't cracked a single piece of literature en route to graduate school to this point, you must understand that there are new and exciting technologies that both come from real biology, how cells manipulate the RNA information in them to control protein synthesis and other things, right? I hope you've heard of RNAi. And certainly in the last year, and it hasn't really even been a year, there's an explosion in information on this technology called CRISPR, which is, again, something borrowed from real biology, but has been really changed into a powerful tool, okay? So maybe in future courses, I'll be addressing this type of information. We're not going to do this here, but you will certainly confront this in your career. Again, how can we manipulate this transfer of information at the genome level with a CRISPR technology editing a piece of DNA one at a time, but now in large sets, in large combinatorial arrays, the same way that RNAi technology has really been propelled into to modern science. And so these data sets are emerging, and they're emerging very, very quickly. We don't necessarily have the tools and the way to think about them, but I argue that very, very soon we're going to be thinking about these types of data sets and how they integrate back with pure sequencing of nucleic acids themselves and proteins. So I needed to point that out. And we'll leave this for now, but I hope if you haven't, you've read a little bit about this. So what I want to focus on for my time with you is understanding the origins of large data sets in the final step of the central dogma in the protein space. So you're well aware of where they come from, proteins, how they're synthesized, but how do we go about interrogating entire sets of proteins from organisms, tissues, cells? So the concept of proteomics. And we really need to spend some time on techniques and technologies because that's where the data is coming from. You need to understand that. And then we're going to talk and discuss about protein-protein interactions. Again, the context here is the way we can interrogate large data sets, complex problems, and accumulate this information. And then eventually you'll understand how we can use computational methods to learn something about biology. And then we'll discuss quantitation, okay, beyond, just like you learned about how DNA sequencing has transformed into RNA-seq, same technologies applied a different way, we can learn something about the dynamics of the system. So sequencing something many, many times at many different states, we're going to take that into the level of proteins and peptides, proteomics. We'll talk about some applications, and then at the end we'll put it all together, and I'll introduce you along the way to some databases and some places where this information is curated, really good places for clever computational biologists, let's say, to go in and sample this information and build hypotheses. So the first and most important thing we'll talk about is mass spectrometry. And we will cover other parts of proteomics, but today it's really hard to even discuss proteomics and not discuss mass spectrometry because clearly it's transformed the field. And most of the data content is coming from this technology. So I'm going to try to distill this down to some very simple concepts so that you could, if you wanted to, explore some of the more sophisticated aspects of the field, but also get good, have a good set of tools and some knowledge to, you know, address things that are in the literature now, even though we may be talking about some papers that, you know, may be 5 or 6 years old, you will still have the information and the ability to access new pieces of literature. So really basic principles. In a mass spectrum, we measure mass to charge, okay? We're going to talk about that. For proteins, today we're going to be talking about peptides and their mass to charge ratio, okay? So a mass spectrometer isn't built just for proteins and peptides. You can measure any molecule that you can ionize. We'll talk about what that means. But for this course, going forward, we're going to talk about measuring proteins and peptides, okay? So it's the same principle measurement. But what's key is, and what I'm going to introduce you is, we have to have an ionization event. Okay, you have to think about, you're ripping a nucleic acid, complex nucleic acid out of a cellular state and you're sequencing it. Okay, we have to liberate proteins from their cells, and we have to do something to them so we can make these measurements, right? And that's what we have to talk about, and the key there is ionization. And so some of the basic components of a mass spectrometer that are important is obviously the sample, right? And we're going to be talking about proteins and how we sample them, but sample goes in, you have to have an ionizer. We're going to talk about that. Then there's a mass filter. So we'll discuss about data content and how that's dealt with, how many, many things are measured at the same time. But again, it's mass to charge, and there has to be a filtering, a way to deal with all of these ions, and then a detector. And we're not going to get much deeper than this into what's inside a mass spec because there's a lot of physics there. There's a lot of interesting chemistries and things that maybe are, most of them are not biologic, right? So that's for another advanced course, not for this course. But it's important to understand these principal components. And this is what, even today, a typical mass spectrometer setup looks like. We're going to talk about the different components a way to separate out the peptides, inject them. This is what a mass spectrometer looks like. It's about, if I'm standing next to it, it's coming up to here. And then the computer, which is really important to make all this machinery talk to each other. But it always likes to point out, what I like to point out is that there's actually an important piece missing. It's someone sitting in that chair, right? This doesn't yet run all by itself without user intervention. So there's no question that getting proteins and peptides into an ionizable form was really, really important in modern-day proteomics. And there were two types of techniques discovered around the same time, reported early in the literature, and this was two types of ionization techniques. And I'll show you what they look like in a second, but we have electrospray ionization, developed by John Fenn, and then we have another one called matrix-assisted laser desorption ionization, MALDI, and I'll show you what that looks like. But the point here is you're taking proteins and peptides from a biological system and we're converting them into gas phase ions so we can measure and detect their mass to charge ratio. So again, we needed to measure either large intact proteins or peptides. We'll talk mostly about peptides today. And we also know that you can also look at protein complexes. We're not going to really talk about that. We're going to talk more about dissecting out individual proteins and peptides. But what's really, really key, after the breakthrough discoveries of how you get a peptide in the gas phase in the mass spec, then there was a very straightforward process of learning how to sequence a peptide inside the mass spectrometer. So getting the proteins from the cell into a phase that we can measure them and then sequencing them, it changes the field. Because just like in genomics or even looking at RNA, you need to know the sequence. We also need to know the sequence of proteins and peptides. So this is just basically what ionization looks like. If you're interested, again, you usually have a liquid sample, typically in some sort of acid because we need charged ions. And there's this complex process of converting this into these small droplets and you get this electrospray. And this is done with electricity. So this is this electrospray needle. The other technique invented was to use a laser pulse to generate similar types of ions, although the physics is not exactly the same, but a laser pulse comes into a matrix where your sample is then laid on some sort of surface, and then ions are liberated from that surface. And these ions are what travel into the mass spec and are measured. So these were such important techniques that actually the Tanaka and Fenn shared the Nobel Prize. And I think what's important for this class to know is that most of the work in electrospray ionization was done at Yale in the chemical engineering department when John Fenn was on the faculty. So again, the guts that we just discussed, sample, source, mass analyzer. This source means the ionization technique. And then I thought it would be useful just to point out some different types of mass analyzers because you may even encounter some of these words in the literature. You may hear about them in other contexts. But these are just different ways that the mass spectrometer can deal with the ions, can sort out peptides, can really measure this information. So words like Orbitrap or a time-of-flight instrument or quadrupole, these are descriptions of either bits, really important pieces of the technology inside the mass spec, or ways that the mass spectrometer is configured to deal with the ions. And we're going to leave that at that, but I wanted to just at least expose you to a few pieces of popular terminology. But now we're going to talk about the real process that takes us from a sample, a protein mixture, and gives us some information that we can use for biological questions. And it's very possible that many of you have performed this experiment, or at least parts of this experiment, and maybe have submitted things to a core or to a collaborator. And so the first step is your sample of interest, a protein mixture. There's many ways, and we'll talk about a few key ways to prepare a sample and you know, how you might think about way sample prep might inform an experiment. But these can be complex or simplified pure proteins. And then we'll go in a moment into detail about enzymatic digestion because while you can measure intact proteins, it's a much more limited technology. Where there's been major advances is addressing proteins and proteomes as peptides. So there's a digestion step where peptides from proteins are generated. These peptides are then resolved through liquid chromatography. We're not going to go too much into detail here. Again, a separate course on the, you know, the finer points of this. But imagine that if you take any protein and digest it, and I'll show you some examples, this introduces a lot of complexity, okay? Even one protein, if you digest it into small pieces and peptides, can be quite complex. So imagine thousands, hundreds of thousands of proteins. Complexity is a huge issue, and it's still a major challenge in the field. But using separation technologies, so just using simple reverse phase chromatography, these complex mixtures can be sorted out, okay, in real time. And so a typical experiment that I'm showing here called shotgun, you may have heard this term before, uses a separation technology like reverse phase chromatography. And as the peptides are separated, there is a constant flow of the sample into the mass spectrometer. So I'll point out at different points that time is important, because we're not just making one measurement. In a typical shotgun proteomics experiment where you're looking at complex mixtures, lots of proteins, a whole proteome, you need to resolve this information over time. So this is where the time component comes from. Is as the complex mixture is eluting off the chromatography step, getting sprayed in real time into the machine, so the spraying, in this case, is the ionization, the data is collected, okay? So what's being collected? So this is an extremely simplified example. Imagine I take two peptides from this mixture, but in the mass spectrometer now, they're ions, okay? So these peaks represent peptide ions with a characteristic mass to charge, right? And I'll show you what that means in detail in this slide, but you should already have an idea that, well, peptides are chains of amino acid, covalently bonded. So the composition of each peptide is what defines the mass. So there's some information there. Most peptides are going to have a unique mass because they have a unique set of amino acids. So they resolve in space, different mass to charges. So the green peptide and the red peptide are different, okay? But the next step, which is really important, and this is all happening real time, very, very fast, is that these individual ions are separated, and a second measurement is made. So the intact peptide is then broken into pieces, and this is a physical rupture of the polypeptide into smaller fragments, and then this produces what we call an MSMS, a second mass spectra, or a tandem mass spectra, where we can learn something about the peptide sequence. So intact peptide into fragments identifies the peptides in the sample, tells us something about the proteins you're working with. Okay, and I'm going to show you how the sequence information comes out in a moment. So first, enzymatic digest. I don't believe there's a Nobel Prize awarded for this, but it was learned very quickly that as great as ionization is, the complexity issue was huge. Large proteins are very difficult to make ionize, especially in the early days. So the breakthrough really came to use proteolytic digest, and one enzyme, trypsin, is still a mainstay technology in the approaches because it cuts very efficiently after lysines and arginines. And this also gives some important properties to the ions themselves, the peptides themselves. We're not going to really discuss that. But needless to say, if you know where the lysines and arginines are spaced in a polypeptide, you can actually predict the types of peptides that are liberated. So I'm just showing you where you have a primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary structures. But really, you have an enzyme that can chop protein, complex proteins, into individual peptides in an ordered way. And it's also going to be important for the downstream data processing. You know up front that you have specificity in the enzymes. You know where the lysines and the arginines are probably going to sit in the peptide. And so the question then comes in, well, we're digesting a protein. We have complex mixtures. And you're sorting things out on the mass spec. And even though I said we're sequencing peptides and proteins, it's not the same as sequencing a piece of DNA. It's not the same as sequencing a nucleic acid space. There are gaps, and there's a huge long list of reasons why we have gaps. Some of them are pretty obvious, like maybe there's a stretch in the protein that doesn't have arginines, so you're going to have another strategy. But I'm just presenting here two different examples, two proteins, where in red are the peptide segments or the protein segments that were sequenced in a mass spec experiment. And sometimes we can understand when there's data gaps what's happening. So in this example, I'm showing you an integral membrane protein, and it turns out that maybe some of the integral membrane segments, which are hydrophobic, are a little bit more difficult to observe. So you see gaps where the protein is passing through the membrane, okay? So there's structural reasons why there's a gaps information. But then perhaps you have soluble protein like an actin, where here I'm showing almost complete coverage, complete sequencing of that. But what's important to understand is in most proteomics experiments, you're only getting a snapshot, pieces of those proteins. And certainly when you do a proteome, you're not getting the data back like you would in a genome, where you have all the information. Every single bit of that open reading frame is sequenced. That's not the case. We're usually deriving our information from bits of the protein with high confidence. There's a lot of sequence information we know with high confidence, but it maps back to only a portion of those proteins, okay? So that's really important to know. There's gaps in the information. And I'm taking a step back now and just showing you, trying to demonstrate some of the complexity in these raw data sets. This is not processed yet. This is just what is being collected. I just said it's simple. It's peptide ions. It's mass to charge. But the reality is here, this is actually real data, but this is a mixture of 5 proteins all digested. And even the trypsin itself is going to show up a little bit. And here is a broad sweep of the mass to charge range, so all the different peptides that are observed at that moment. And every peak, represented by a dot, is a different peptide from the mixture. And appreciate that this is maybe just a fraction of a second in time. Let's say this data was acquired over 90 minutes. And every fraction of a second, or 1 second, you see all this information. And then if you dive down deep into this, you can see, for example, here are 2 different peptides that they're very close in mass to charge. They're distinct, they're different. They may even come from a different protein. But the mass to charge is pretty close. So there's been advances in technology to get in the mass spectrometer, the elements inside, to get very high mass accuracy measurements. So you could tell the difference between a few Daltons or even tens to hundreds to billionths of a Dalton. Right? And that's represented just by the resolution. So if you can't see it because of the light, I'm telling you that there is enough distance between those to differentiate them. Okay? And so there's a lot of complexity, but that all can be sorted out with partially knowing that the intact peptides are resolved and you have exact mass measurement or mass to charge. But also, there's one more thing. I'm going to jump back. I keep saying mass to charge, but I wanted to give a very simple example so you can understand where it's coming from. Let's imagine we have a 100 Dalton peptide. It carries a single charge. It's 100 Daltons divided by 1, so it has a 100 mass to charge. You could have that exact same peptide carry 2 charges, right? This is the ionization part of it, right? But then it's 100 divided by 2, it's 50. So in our imaginary protein or peptide, you could get 3 different peaks in the same sweep. The same peptide could ionize in 3 different states, but it would be the same. So that's the mass to charge ratio. But the beauty of it is you can go back, and if you know the composition of that peptide, you can figure it out. Yep. Question?
How do you know the fact that these peptides have their own charges on them already before you even put them on?
They do. And so I'm sort of glossing over some of the ion theories here. But the composition of the solution that the mixture is in, the way it's ionized in the needle, you get a net charge, right? You get a net charge of 1 or 2, and it really comes down to the number of protons that are being added to the peptide. So there's some more complexities in charge, but it can all distill down to averages of 1, 2, or 3 protons, even 4 or 5, all right? But that's a good point. But we are simplifying it here because as a rule, you can go back and find that the majority of the species are going to carry 1, 2, 3, or 4 charges. And it allows you to figure out all of that information and to come back to intact peptides, right? So the last bit of gory details I wanted to walk through here is the what is in a tandem mass spectra? What is in the sequencing component? Intact ion, as we just said, with a charge. And if you look, this is a generic polypeptide. Here's the R group here, 1, 2, 3, 4. And these are the places where you're going to see a break in the mass spec. And so imagine if this polypeptide lines up and it's the R group is A, B, C, D, right? Fictional R groups here. Each of those has a different mass associated with it. So if you have a fragment that has just an A with a mass to charge that's lighter than a fragment that has an A plus a B or an A plus a B plus a C, what you should see immediately is that the difference between these peaks is the addition of another amino acid. And there are only, well, for this example, there's 20 amino acids, right? We'll talk about modifications later in the reality of biology, but 20 amino acids gives you a smaller constrained space. What are the possible differences in this type of sequence of the peptide, okay? And it's this theme repeated over and over again, combined with the information at the genome level, that allows you to go back and reassemble a peptide sequence, okay? So, and this is, sorry, this is cut off a little bit, but this is the whole thing put together. Here's a complex mess of MS1 spectra, and then a tandem MS spectra of another, and this is an example of what a real piece of data would look like. It's not a nice, perfectly same intensity cartoon that I just drew. But if you isolated a single peak and mass to charge inside the mass spec, got a tandem mass spectra, all of those fragments could be assigned, and then you could work backwards and assemble a partial but very accurate assembly of the amino acids. And now you could do this, one could do this just by sitting there looking, and as we just walked through, I could figure out the differences between these two ions as, let's say, an arginine molecular weight. But actually the real power and what makes this on the scale of a proteome instead of just a protein or one peptide at a time is that there's computational steps and genome information. In a typical, today, if you're doing an experiment, rarely, I would argue, you're just trying to sample a protein at random. I have no idea what I'm studying. Right? You usually have that information. I have purified this protein. I'm working with this organism. I'm working with this organelle. And most of the time, you have a genome behind that. You know it's yeast. You know it's human. So that constrains the possible peptide space that's actually in your sample. So when you come back and you have raw data that predicts, or well, predicts but supports an amino acid sequence, that could be matched back to the genome. You know what the order of amino acids should be for an actin that comes from a human, right? And if you see that in your data, you can use sophisticated algorithms to predict a probability that you're correct. And those have advanced to the point where we know to sometimes 99% or greater certainty that that peptide is what it is because we've seen the sequence and we've validated that. And we can even estimate the false positive rates. Okay, so now we're armed with sophisticated mass specs, computational methods to deconvolute lots and lots of data, just like a next generation sequencing algorithm would work. You can start putting back together all of the information about the proteins in your sample. And that's really what we want to know. We want to know what are the proteins in the sample. Okay? And that's where we are with proteomics and mass spectrometry. So now we can study expression, location, interaction, function of proteins, organelles, whole organisms. And I just added this little disclaimer because I may have shown you this nice cartoon where the world works with 20 amino acids and that's it, but that's actually not true. We know that's not true. That proteins are modified extensively after they're synthesized. Proteins are phosphorylated. They're glycosylated. They have methyl groups put on them. Those are changes to the chemistry of the R groups. But we have a technology that really doesn't care about the composition of the amino acids. It's reporting a mass to charge. So if you're armed with the information of the genome and the sample you're working with, you can also figure out where modifications are in amino acids. You can find maybe this peptide looks just like it is. It's got all the mass to charge. It's exactly like it does, unmodified. But you could find a percentage of that same species that maybe carries a phosphate or an acetyl group. And that's where there's been some really cool advances and a deeper understanding of what proteomes are really doing in cells. And we're going to talk about that. So now I wanted to spend a good amount of time trying to take you through the history of proteomics and weave in stories about using a mass spectrometer, but also some important advances that have nothing to do with mass spec that have taught us how proteomes are composed and what that information means. You have a question?
Can mass spec give information about structure or orientation?
Yes. Yes. Spatial orientation, not yet like in a cell, maybe not to a single molecule resolution, but there are now, and there have been in the works for many years, ways to label and study proteins and structure. And that's beyond the scope of this course, but after I could point you in the direction to some of those studies.
I had a question. You said that sometimes there's gaps in the sequence. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to like target certain areas of the protein?
Yes.
Yes,
yes. I presented a textbook example of we'll use trypsin, it cuts after lysines, arginines, and it'll give us this, and you could even predict from a sequence, a piece of sequence information, where the tryptic peptides would sit. So a way to get at your question, you use a different enzyme, for example. Right? There are enzymes that choose other amino acids to cleave. So if you have an area that's impenetrable to trypsin, maybe you have another amino acid. So there's, I mean, as you can imagine, given enough time, someone clever has really figured out a way to extend the capabilities of any technique. And so many of these areas have been explored, some better than others, right? So here is a decade's worth of work of proteomics. And I like this way to go through it because we're going to focus on a single organism so that, you know, we'll try to keep everything the same. It's the same genome. We're going to have a sense of how many proteins we're working with. And we'll talk about how technology has advanced the depth and the amount of information you can get from any proteome. And at the end, we'll shift into mammalian cells, and I'll point out some key challenges there. But we're going to talk about budding yeast. And from the very beginning, and this is a busy slide, but we're going to go step by step in different chunks. So the first chunk is focusing on some of the first experiments to really understand a whole proteome, right? Not just one protein at a time, but everything. Okay, and there's some really cool paper that we'll talk about. And in the earliest work, it was that the groups used mass spec. They used techniques to pull out protein-protein interactions and complexes and go through and identify all the proteins in those complexes. But one of the first really exciting experiments that came out that really brought in a new era of proteomics was this study in 2001 that really introduced the idea that you could just take all whole yeast cell and you could prepare all the proteins from the cell, chop them up with trypsin, then resolve all those peptides over time and reassemble the yeast proteome. So you didn't have to go through some of the technical and labor-intensive steps that we'll talk about and other ways to address a proteome. You could just do it in one shot, just like you would imagine doing a genome. Isolate the DNA, sequence it, get the information. Isolate the protein, sequence them, get the information. Okay, and so that was really first achieved, and this idea of shotgunning a proteome came out in 2001. And there's, you know, it's a stolen term because the idea of shotgunning a genome had been around and was already in practice. So this is just some data from that first study, and just to try to illustrate how even as clever as we think we are as experimentalists, we really need technological leaps. And in my career, I've went from Sanger sequencing things to next generation sequencing, and there's just no comparison, right? These orders of magnitudes leaps, right? So in that first study, the Washburn study, to look at a very large and significant portion of the yeast proteome. In this case, they resolved and identified 1,400 proteins. Okay, you may know that yeast has around 6,000 genes, so that's still a fraction, but it was impressive. But it really took them about 82 hours of work just for that one data set. Okay, and now, or well, not now, but I just compared this to 10 years after in our lab, just using a different type of mass spectrometer, something that was more advanced. I had to take no credit for any of the guts inside that machine. It's just something you buy and plug in. We're getting, you know, almost the same data content in 60 minutes, right? That's the technology. It's not the sample prep, right? So the pace is still set by techniques and technology, and it's still orders of magnitude behind genome. Okay, that's just the fact. That I argue that proteomics, we haven't had our next generation sequencing technology yet. But there's still a lot of good stuff out there. So another data set just to show that we can address a proteome where we could take not even an instrument that's not all that old and do the type of workflow that Washburn used, where you take a complex sample and you break it up into a lot smaller parts, and then you run them one after each other, one after each other. And that's a long experiment, and you have to do 35 runs, and it takes 3,000 minutes, right? And then you end up with 74% of the E. coli proteome, which is exciting, and we're doing quantitation here. But you just get a slightly different machine with a little bit more money, and you're getting almost the same data content in 200 minutes, right? So it's the technology that's really driving this. It's getting faster and better and deeper. And what that means for as an experimentalist is it opens up more possibilities to do exciting experiments, to address whole proteomes. But we are always waiting for advances in instrumentation. So we're going to take a step away from mass spec for a moment to talk about addressing a proteome in a different way. And two important papers, again, in yeast, really published very close to each other, are trying to understand for the first time how maybe an entire proteome would interact, how do proteins interact. So a proteome scale experiment that has nothing to do with the mass spec. Now, before our, let's just leave it at that. I'll go back to some, there are ways, and we'll focus on this next, about how you can use a mass spectrometer to get the same information. But these elegant studies used a really powerful system that was designed using yeast and first deployed on individual proteins one at a time. And it was this really clever synthetic construct where you could take a protein that normally would bind a promoter region and then activate gene expression, but you would split that into two pieces. So you'd have this Gal4 binding domain, which would bind the promoter region, then you would have this activation domain. And so if they're separate, that doesn't work. Okay, and in this cartoon, imagine that you have an open reading frame that drives a selection. So a cell doesn't live unless it has this protein. So you have to reconstitute that function to get the cells to live. So the really clever adaptation of this was, well, we can make some fusion proteins, and I'm sure maybe you've seen this before, if these two proteins interact, the two baits interact, you reconstitute this Gal4 protein, and then you get expression of your marker, okay? And this was used for a long time, one at a time, this protein interacts with this one. However, these two groups decided, let's just do that for all the genes in yeast and try to understand how proteins interact across the whole proteome. So this is, at the time, just a massive undertaking to make huge combinatorial arrays of every different piece of an ORF combined to one piece of that Gal4 fusion protein compared to the other, so you could just do a massive mating experiment, okay, cross this one with that one, and ask the question, when does the right combination stick together and drive a selectable marker? So this is massive yeast 2 hybrid assays. So this was carried out. I'm sure you could look in the paper and figure out how long it took. But the results were, in one publication, they identified almost 5,000 interactions among 3,200 proteins. And this is impressive because they're way beyond what a mass spec could deliver in this type of interactions, right? They're getting, this is exciting because they're getting closer to understanding an entire proteome and maybe addressing all the genes in an organism, way ahead of where we were with mass specs at the time, right? So these are very relevant and still very useful. I think they're being, I know they're being done very differently today, but, you know, very impressive data set. And it was an equally impressive effort, but the numbers were a little bit lower in the competing publication that came out around the same time. So the advantages of this is, while it's in vivo, that's nice. Simple, if you ignore the fact you need like a huge factory of robots or a lot of maneuvering, but simple enough to execute. But some of the disadvantages, as I just mentioned, it's hard to do on a large scale. False positives are a real problem, or, you know, false negatives, right? Because the biology gets in the way. You're making synthetic genes, and yes, they do report real interactions, but at the same time, what I didn't really stress is that this is a system that's reconstituting the activity at a promoter. So that means the complex has to come into the nucleus and has to assemble and work properly. Well, there's proteins that wouldn't quite work that way. You couldn't necessarily expect to have a properly folded functional integral membrane protein reconstitute this way. So there may be gaps, right? We know there's gaps. The people that did this work, and even today, we know there's gaps. So there may be other ways to think about how to overcome these things. But nevertheless, if you could do that type of an experiment with the yeast genome, then some brave and clever groups decided, well, you could do the same thing with the human genome. We could do it in yeast. We just make a fusion of every single human protein, put it into the same two hybrid system, and ask the question, which two human proteins interact? And so Mark Vidal's group pulled that off, and this paper published in 2005 was looking at almost 8,000 different human genes, and they addressed these many, and they got data on 7,000, and they were able to map 10,000 interactions, right? So even in 2005, very difficult to get this much information about the human proteome with a mass spectrometer, right? Here's a lot of really important information about interactions. And they were clever enough to ask the question at the time, and this landscape has changed radically, especially since 2005, but let's imagine that there was a good number of human disease genes understood, and you'd ask the question, what were the interactions between genes that are known to cause diseases? Are there new stories? Can we connect new proteins and their properties to human disease? And they were able to map that. And there's some interesting clusters that came out, and they could learn something more about the human interactome. And so I've already thrown up one of these hairballs that sometimes they're called affectionately, and you may discuss this in other contexts later in the course, but just the trying to simplify interactions, and this type of nomenclature and these presentations are still a work in progress, and there's people with much more expertise in this than I, but the general concept is you have nodes and edges, and these edges are the connections. And what's exciting about thinking about a proteome this way is there's a lot of different types of pieces of information you can encode in this. Some of these lines could actually represent a physical interaction. Like I showed you the human interactome, these two things touch, we know that. But you can also color code and think about different ways that interactions work. Maybe a color code brings together classes of proteins, like metabolic pathways. So there's a way to think about interactions that go beyond just two things touching. This happens to be an impressive computational effort of just trying to rein in all of the published interactions at the time and map them. And so this, you know, this goes beyond what Vidal's group did with yeast 2 hybrid. This is combining all the literature, all the large-scale efforts to get a human interactome of over 100,000 interactions in one massive, you know, impenetrable hairball, but at least that information's out there. So it's a way to think about, and now you know with these brief introductions, where does this information come from? How do you generate these maps? We know we can do interaction studies with the yeast, and we can understand that a protein-protein interaction may be a physical complex, but it may be indirect. You may have multi-protein complexes and scaffolds. It's the concept that there's one protein with many different proteins stuck to it, right, that brings things together, like a ribosome or something like that, or even more complicated. And we know that interactions are also can be transient. You have this a very simplistic demonstration of a kinase phosphorylating a substrate, but that's a type of interaction, and then you have metabolic pathways where these two enzymes may never touch each other in a physical interaction, but they're essential to carry out a process. So these are all types of pieces of biological information that are relevant in the way proteins interact. And so just, so we've started with this the top portion of the tour through the yeast proteome, and we're going to go to the second section where now we're going to switch to using a mass spectrometer to understanding protein complexes and going beyond yeast two hybrid systems. But right here in the middle, we're not going to discuss it after this. I wanted to point out that there were two other really important proteome-wide experiments that had nothing to do with the mass spec. And it was the simple process of labeling every open reading frame in yeast with a green fluorescent protein. And then just one at a time, 6,000 strains, asking the question, is it expressed? Does it glow? You immediately would know how many open reading frames are active. You could validate the proteome by the way it's expressed. But then you already, now you have in your back pocket every single ORF tagged with GFP, so you could ask questions like, how is it organized? Where are they localized? You can't ask localization questions with a yeast 2 hybrid system. It's really tough to ask localization questions with this much sophistication with a mass spec, because you have to break everything up and chop it up and throw it into a mass spectrometer. But looking at an entire organism, the proteome distribution inside a living cell, one ORF at a time, is a very powerful experiment. And it still is, I think, a highlight of addressing an entire proteome's worth of information with an experimental model. It has yet to be replicated in a human cell, but I think that's coming. So the other exciting innovation that came from the same groups was they had one strain of, or many strains of yeast that had GFP, then they had another strain of yeast where they put in a little clever handle called a tap tag. You may have heard of this. This is a fusion protein that gives you a molecular handle, so you can purify proteins. Every single ORF in the organism will be purified the same way. Why would you want to purify a protein? Well, if you don't know the answer to that question, I'll tell you. Because here's an example. I want to know what proteins are interacting in a cell. So one way to do that is to tag your protein of interest. And using this tandem approach, you have two types of tags. The first one, protein A, binds to an immunoglobulin domain. They interact. And so here in this cartoon, you have the bait, and here are these interesting proteins that are stuck to it. The open circles represent contaminants. Okay, these are things that aren't supposed to be there, and you want to get rid of them. So you get a massive purification here. Then you can use a second functional domain. In this older version of the technology, you have a protein that can bind to something in the presence or absence of calcium. So you get then a second, more specific interaction, which allows you to wash away all the other contaminants, leaving behind a highly purified native protein complex. Key here is, it's the same question we just asked with yeast 2 hybrid, except you're not making fusion domains other than baiting one of them, right? And you can recapitulate more interactions, and benefit is maybe they're more relevant. Maybe these are protein interactions that would never be picked out of a 2 hybrid system, or they occur in the proper place in the proper time. Much more access to the native state of the proteome, okay? And so this group, part of the effort was in Jonathan Weissman's lab, same group that did the GFP tagging. They just tap tagged every ORF in yeast. And then what this allowed them to do with collaborators and some time is to just purify everything, one at a time. And then, it shouldn't be shocking to you, when you have a tube full of purified complexes, what can you do? You can chop it up, you can inject it into a mass spec and ask the question, what's in the sample? OK? Okay, so they did this systematically over and over and over again, digested the proteins, they knew it was yeast, they knew the genome, they could reassemble the peptide information that they got out of the mass spec, and what emerged was the identity and composition of all these protein complexes. And that's just summarized here, this cartoon that here's my pure protein, here's the interesting things I want to know, and here's, you know, gobs and gobs of data that churns out of the mass spec and gets interpreted back to give you the interactome, which in this paper, you have now 7,000 protein complexes and interactions. Again, way beyond at the time what you could do with one shot in a mass spec. And again, you can't get interaction information by just chopping up a whole cell and doing a shotgun experiment. You have to introduce some other clever technique like this. So this is just a summary of some of the things they found. You know, they did tag everything. Well, not everything. So they were able to tag at least 4,000 proteins at the time. And then they claimed half of those were successful purifications. I think in the paper they made this some of the reasons why they didn't get some of them. But they were pretty happy at the end because they felt like the interesting thing here is you wouldn't necessarily have to tag every single protein to recover most of the proteome, because maybe some of those genes that resist tagging or they just didn't work technically would come out in other protein complexes, right? So they could get information beyond their set of tools because they're protein interactions. And so they were able to map out, again, big and little hairballs, how a proteome is organized, right? And this is really one of the first large studies that showed the entire proteome is organized into complexes with a whole bunch of different functional reasons, right? Obvious ones like big complexes that are ribosomes and things like that, but also interesting new mega complexes and then orphan complexes, right, at the time that are orphan, or maybe these are specialized things to be discovered. What do they mean? You know, we had no idea that these two things interacted. You know, time will tell what they are. But all this information is then curated and archived and then can be mined later with new information. And there's no doubt that maybe some of these small complexes have emerged as big stories in future publications, and now we know they interact. So really important projects, really important archives. So how are we going to do all this outside of a yeast cell? How are we going to use all these exciting technologies to address more complicated organisms? Let's just say like a human cell, genomes are larger, they're much more complex, there's more genes, there's more proteins, there's more compartments. How are we going to address this? And the answer has been to take on segments, take on smaller challenges, clusters of genes, themes. But I can also report now, so Steve Gigi was here just a couple months ago. While they've done some really cool work and they're the proteome engine behind some of these projects, they are, and they have a funded project where they're basically tagging all the human genes, purifying as many complexes as they can, and just marching through the protein-protein interactions. So just like the yeast study, they're doing the hard work of just purifying everything and ask the question, what's there? And so that will come out, I think, in two parts. So to be determined, but we're going to see the first draft of the human interactome done with tagging, purification, and mass spectrometry. But some warm-up projects, if you can call it that, some really important projects were done on targeted pieces. So this, we're not going to have a deep dive into what's really important about autophagy, but imagine if you wanted to know how the proteome is organized in a process where you have multiple different organelles involved. Some of the genes are known, some are not. But how would a proteome organize itself? What would be the stories that we could learn about a complex process inside all eukaryotic cells? And so they used the bait and purify strategy where they could target and make, you know, 65. If you're thinking about this Krogan study, it looks small. Like, well, come on, you know, they tagged out 6,000 things, you know, and they got 2,000 things. But again, it's complexity. It's the the difference in doing genetics in human cell versus yeast cell. So incremental progress. But nevertheless, with 65 bait proteins chosen very carefully from experts in autophagy field, using a strategy where they could immunoprecipitate. Here we're not talking about tap tagging, we're just talking about epitopes that, again, pull out interacting proteins via a bait, 65 of them. They were, at the end, able to confidently identify from 65 baits 2,500 proteins in various complexes. So again, here's one of these really complicated interaction networks where different functional classes and different proposed functions are wired together with this information in the edges, okay? And along the way, they developed some important interaction or some important tools to understand which proteins are really of high confidence. And so this is some metrics of the mass spec data itself, the experiments, the types of experiments they did. But they really wanted to understand the confidence in the identity of the proteins, and they wanted to understand the enrichment, like fold enrichment. So they could say with confidence that we have really pulled out a true protein complex, and we're not just pulling out things that stuck to the bead, right? So think about the control. You know, what? How do we know that these are really bona fide interactions that are in the cell versus just a bunch of stuff that sticks to the antibody, right? So the mass specs are very sensitive. You can see thousands of proteins, and some of them are a thousandfold more abundant in the sample than others, but how do you know that for sure? And so they figured out ways to do this with some of the properties in the mass spec, which we won't go into the details, but nevertheless, they really got very, very good, and they made some sophisticated software and approaches to this, which now, as I told you, they're applying to the human interactome as a whole, not just after autophagy. But and then one last, just a small point about interaction mapping and what was brought out in this paper on autophagy. They really wanted to think very carefully about how to represent information. So imagine this is a protein complex, and someone asked about structure and that really important information, like how are these things really organized in space, right? You don't know that for sure if you're just taking things that are in a complex and then chopping it all up, which I just described, and shooting in the mass spec. You basically destroy all of that spatial information. It's lost. You're just taking everything in a big pot and chopping it up. So you have to be very careful about how you represent information and what do you really know. You can't tell if two proteins are stuck to your bait or stuck to each other in a way that they co-purify with the bait. So this is just a very complicated way to address a problem with protein-protein interactions in the mass spec. You're going to lose the architecture of that complex. You're going to lose some of that information. You know they all come down together, but you don't necessarily know who's talking to who, okay? There are other papers, which I haven't pointed out here, and other very clever and labor-intensive studies where they, other groups have taken information like this. And so let's say this is protein complex one, like I have to know what this protein complex is. So they start with this bait and they pull down all these things. Then they separately bait each one of the interacting proteins and repeat again. And so what that allows you to do is start to ask the question, complex one, and then which two recapitulate that complex and try to draw maps by doing separate, very painstaking recapitulation of this bait, pull down, shoot, okay? That's not done in this study. Instead, they tried to take the information, maybe they had some support, and try to distill it down to known interactors and simplify it so that when they draw this, believe it or not, it's actually a constrained interaction network. It's much smaller, and it's much more solid. So the other clever thing that's emerging, again, tons of work, but really inspiring, is going beyond just a catalog of proteins and complex, right? That's powerful information, but if you want to go beyond that, ask the question, well, we just mapped, in this experiment, we mapped 65 important proteins and then connected them to networks of proteins that control autophagy. So we've learned some new information. So let's take all of that information and design a functional experiment. So they went back, took many of those complexes, then designed an assay where they could target the genes with small interfering RNAs, knock them down, look at their interaction network, and then come up with a way to ask the question, does it promote or inhibit autophagy? And layer that information back onto their network, okay? So now you have a static map, but it's important. And then you layer up on top of that which elements actually have a functional effect on the biology you're interested in. So again, that's, you know, this is a lot of work, and that'll emerge, and no one group is going to tackle all the functional possibilities of the entire proteome, but the point here is to show you how themes are emerging, how we're taking the same technologies and the same approach to understanding a whole organism like yeast and applying them all to understand complex problems in mammalian biology and human biology. And so where is some of this information curated, right? So I mean, you can probably imagine that there's more than one group looking at protein-protein interactions, and there's a lot of mass specs out there, and there's a lot of talented people. So large consortiums have sprung up. There's a lot of effort to try to keep this together, come up with standards. And so this is just a screenshot of now, actually, when I started this course, it was best to go to the MINT database, Molecular Interactions, but now that's all being funneled into at least one source. This one is in the UK, where they're collecting this information. And so what I'm showing here is the progress of the field of protein-protein interactions. Now, most of this is fueled by mass spectrometry, right? Proteomics done with a mass spec. This is not all massive yeast-2 hybrid efforts, okay? But what's interesting, and these trends are continuing, in red are the number of proteins that are deposited, right? So you can always find numbers on, so here's 2013, 35,000 proteins, 200,000 interactions. And what's cool to see is that the complexity isn't necessarily in what's encoded in the genome, but it's really how the proteome is organized and how the complexes are organized and how proteins and proteomes are configured for different biology, right? And so that information is exploding really, really quickly by, again, adapting the same approaches that were proven in yeast and then being extended to many, many other organisms. So most of these databases, you could go in and say, okay, I just want to know what's going on in human, I just want to know what's going on in yeast or plants. That information is there, and it's all curated. And there's different levels you could go in and say, I only want interactions that were done this way with TAP tags or something like that. But it's a powerful resource, and it's constantly growing, and it's just fun to see how this is emerging. And again, if you think about it, proteomes are organized in networks. That function is encoded in how proteins interact, and that's just being proven at, you know, very, very a faster rate, really, than the number of proteins. So that's interesting. Maybe when this finally slows down, it's time to move out of looking for protein interactions. I don't know. So I'm just about to wrap up. I'm going to go a little bit into Monday's lecture, but we're going to shift now from just descriptive information. Now, I've already touched on things that are beyond descriptive, right? But what are the protein coding segments of a genome for sure? How many proteins are expressed? What's in a complex? How many proteins are in a complex? And that is important because if you just looked at a genome, you would know all the coded information, but you wouldn't necessarily know what that means for the organism. But perhaps if you got a protein interaction network, you could see how things were assembled, and you might get some information about, okay, these genes encode these complexes, and that gives me some information about how the thing works. But there's another component that we really need to address. It's the dynamics, right? And maybe you're not going to really see the real function of these systems and really understand how proteins work in concert until you look at how they change over time. And that concept has been, you know, on the minds of many groups, and trying to push the same techniques and technology that you can go in with a mass spec and pick out a protein, pick out a peptide, and answer with certainty, it is in my sample. But now it's the question, how does that change over time? How does expression change over time? What's the difference between condition A, condition B? To interject some hypothesis-driven research into the same tools and ask this on a grand scale for proteomes or individual proteins. And so I'm just going to touch on this a little bit. I'll review this again, but the sequence information is there. I'll point this out here because it's fresh in your mind, but I've mentioned several times about post-translational modifications. And this is where understanding dynamics and really an attention to quantitation has really come into the field to try to understand how protein modifications are controlled in a cell. And how is the proteome statically, if you will, expressed but then changed dynamically over time and repurposed by enzymatic processes. So the cool part is that in the same sequencing information, you know if an amino acid is unmodified or native or whatever, or if it's modified. And so what I've highlighted here is in the same type of data, you could find out if you had, let's say, a phosphorylated threonine. It would tell you that this peptide comes from a protein that was acted upon by a kinase. Okay? And we'll go into next time about how you can take that sequence information and introduce dynamics, you can study dynamics using the same approach. And then there's another technology, and it is a mass spectrometer, it's really the same principles, but it's designed a little bit different to also extract quantitative information. And this, I'm giving you a scheme that is the same process of an intact peptide divided up into fragments, and then those fragments are detected. But what's interesting about this configuration inside the mass spec is there's the ability to perform these tasks, but then isolate them. So the concept here is, here's a mixture of peptides. Okay, this pool now is circles. Okay, and this is a peptide of interest. And here we want to bring it into another separate mass analyzer, okay, or a filter, if you will. And we're going to blast this intact peptide into fragments. Okay, this step, this is the MS, and this is the tandem MS that we were talking about in shotgun space. But the difference is we know what the mass to charges of this, and we also know what the mass to charges of these fragments. So then we can isolate one of the fragments. And if you set this experiment up properly and use the right mass spec, in this case, these are called triple quadrupoles. These are three of these quadrupoles arrays that allows you to guide the ions in this manner. What I'm showing you is the same peptide sequence, right? Intact peptide to fragment, showing you like our hypothetical peptide is called peptide. These are the three fragments. But if this process is monitored over time, again, the time component here is using the chromatography step, you get a quantitative readout of this peptide and its sequence, okay? And so this is just a different way to configure the mass spec to move around the peptides and ions, but to keep track of the mass to charge and the peptide information. So now you can measure this with a lot of reproducibility, a lot of precision, and you can introduce a couple other tricks for quantitation and follow individual peptides. And I'm showing you, just like in a shotgun experiment, I'm giving you one example, but imagine there's 10,000 of those things going on at the same time. So you can track hundreds and thousands of proteins. The same types of workflows can be applied here. And so what we'll talk about next time is introducing labels, introducing mass labels, And this will go back to, I hope it connects back to techniques to keep track of nucleic acids. This condition is labeled one color, this condition is labeled not this color. Or this genome has this barcode, this genome has that barcode. So you can keep track of them in the experiment, but you can make the same measurement. And so in the mass spec, we're going to introduce labels that introduce a different mass. And so since the machine is simple as sorting out masses, I'll show you how one group of cells will be light or lighter, and another group of cells will be heavy. And that means all the peptides that are derived from those populations can be separated out in the mass spec. So we're going to keep track of peptides, proteins, cells, biological processes by simply introducing mass tags. And since it's a mass spectrometer, we can keep them separate. And we'll go into details, but it'll all boil down to our ability to do heavy and light cells. And if this is a mass to charge, the light one goes here, the heavy one goes here. So if they're mixed together, you can do ratios. Okay, I'm going to cut it off there, and I'll see you Monday.